white people get in there.
Secretary of State and Principal, the Albright Group, LLC.
Hello, everybody. I have to say that this is a part that I love because it really is a way to show the extent to which President Clinton has a wide influence and has empowered all of us to do some new deeds. And so I'm very, very pleased to announce some commitments this morning. Could I ask Walter Shorenstein, Mayor Gavin Newsom, Jane Nelson, and Mary Jacobson to come up and join me? Okay. This is a very exciting commitment. The organizations that are involved are obviously Walter Shorenstein, Douglas Ehlers, and Walter Isaacson, who is president of the Aspen Institute. And the point here is to build a network of national and local public-private partnerships in support of community-based redevelopment efforts in New Orleans. I think this is so essential for anybody that's been down there to have this kind of an effort. It is building on the leadership dialogue sponsored by Walter and others in their 2005 Clinton Global Initiative commitment. The gentlemen involved in this are going to work with a number of local partners to revitalize the Broadmoor neighborhood in New Orleans. If any of you have been down there to see that, needs it very badly. They have chosen to focus on a single neighborhood to show the extent to which dedicated public and private partnerships can succeed even against very major social problems. This neighborhood was one of the most diverse in the city and was 8 feet under water following Hurricane Katrina. And a network of public-private partnerships that's established will empower the local leadership and leverage resources for the redevelopment plan created by the community's residents. I just think that it's a very important effort, and I'm sure will have great impact not only on the neighborhood but also on getting others to be helpful. So congratulations, and thank you very, very much. And I must say, Mayor Newsom's doing fabulous things in San Francisco. Can I now invite Jim Zogby to come up? For those that you don't know Jim, he is host and producer of Abu Dhabi TV and the president of the Arab American Institute and a very good friend. And I think that one of the exciting aspects, as I understand it, Jim, this is something that you decided to do after being a part of the religious discussions yesterday, which is exactly what we want, people who are inspired as they sit here. The commitment is to foster dialogue between the U.S. and Arab students through a series of live interactive TV programs. The idea here is partnering with Americans for Informed Democracy, Abu Dhabi TV will create 4 live interactive television programs with participating audiences drawn from American campuses and campuses in Lebanon, Palestine, Jordan, and the United Arab Emirates. The programs will be broadcast in Europe, in the United States, and across the Arab world. And it will also, they will be linked and carried on in the U.S. on Link television. The interesting aspect about this is that the interactive sessions will allow students to speak to one another and break down, obviously, the two frequent barriers of distrust and ignorance. I think this is essential. Jim has been playing such an important role in this already, but I think to have this additional way of talking with each other, I think, is a real contribution to what we're trying to do. So, Jim, thank you very, very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists for today. Jaime Lerner, former mayor of Curitiba, Brazil. architect and urban planner, Instituto Jaime Lerner. Ken Livingston, Mayor of London. William McDonough, founding partner and principal, William McDonough and Partners, and McDonough Brownguard Design Chemistry. Nadon Long, Neil Akhani, Chief Executive Officer and Managing Director, Infosys Technologies Limited. Our moderator, Judy Woodruff, Special Correspondent, NewsHour with Jim Lehrer.
Thank you. I'm Judy Woodruff, and I am honored to be here as part of the Clinton Global Forum, and especially to be part of this interesting discussion that we're going to have over the next 45 minutes, the cities of the future. We're going to talk about the vision for the cities that our children and our grandchildren are going to live in. We're going to talk about the challenges we face in realizing that vision. 500 years ago, William Shakespeare asked, "What is the city but the people?" And, of course, that's what we're really here to talk about, the people who live in these cities. In 1800, only 2% of the world's population lived in cities. Today, for the first time in history, over half of the world's population now lives in urban areas, with about 160,000 people, we are told, moving from rural areas to urban areas every single day, 160,000. By the year 2030, it is expected, predicted, that 60% of the world's population will live in urban areas. This is a mass migration. It is occurring mainly, as we know, in developing countries. It has enormous implications for health, for poverty, for the environment, for relations between human beings. We know that cities can serve as engines of progress for civilization. At the same time, they can be flashpoints for everything from disease to conflict. And yet, urbanization continues relentlessly faster than we're able to keep up with it. With this panel, we bring together four business and government leaders who are uniquely qualified to talk about the world that we live in and its cities. They are, as you just heard, Jaime Lerner. He's the former mayor of Curitiba in the state of Parana, Brazil. He's the former governor of Parana State. He is an architect and an urban planner by profession. Ken Livingstone, second from my left, is the mayor of the city of London. He has been since the year 2000. He's been active in London's governance and in the British Parliament for the last three decades. William McDonough, who is at the other end of the panel, world-renowned architect, founding a partner of his own firm, William McDonough Partners. And finally, seated next to me, Nanda Nilekani, CEO and Managing Director of Infosys Technologies Limited, based, as we know, in India. He's been with the company for the last 25 years. So, Mr. Nilekani, I'm going to begin with you. You founded Infosys. It is one of, if not India's largest, IT services firms. You've been credited with tackling some of the enormous problems in Bangalore. Talk about what those problems were and talk about how you personally why you personally felt it was important to tackle these and how you view the outcome of this.
Sure. I think, as we discussed, the urbanization that is happening today is unprecedented. One, because of the large numbers that are coming into cities. Second, because of the pace at which they're coming in. India is getting in 10 million people a year into cities. China is getting in 14 million people a year into cities. So it's really unprecedented in history. And third, in India, it's also, you have to add the fact that it's a democratic system, so when all these people come into cities, they are voters, and therefore they have an influence on what happens. Our interest in urban issues came about from the fact that Infosys, for example, is growing dramatically. We were 2,000 people in 1999. We are about 58,000 people today. And we added 25,000 people this year to our employee base, a lot of them in India. And unless we get our urban act together, unless we have good cities, sustainable cities where people can live, work, play, we felt that our entire industry was going to be really affected by the fact that we don't really have great cities. So for the last 6 to 7 years, personally as well as the firm, we have been involved in Bangalore city and dealing with the challenges. Now, Bangalore has particular challenges because it's grown very rapidly. It's become really the capital of the high-tech revolution in India. And it has a huge amount of migrants coming in, both rural migrants coming from villages, as well as urban migrants coming for jobs in technology sector like us. And it's a very complex thing because to really make the cities work, you have to both have political sustainability and financial sustainability. And what happens in India is that cities are politically weak because they don't really have the kind of clout in the legislature which is commensurate with their economic size and their population. And therefore, there's a big tug of war about the resources that can be done for a city. So one of the things that we are trying to figure out is how to improve that. The second thing is financial sustainability. You know, how do you make sure cities raise their own taxes? How do you make sure that cities get a fair share of the taxes raised by the state or the federal government? How do you make sure cities get an adequate part of the money from assets they own? How do you make sure cities can raise money in the bond market? So a lot of the reforms that we've been suggesting are things that help in improving the financial and political sustainability of cities.
And this passion that you have comes from the private sector. Jaime Lerner, for you, you were in the public sector. Talk about your experience in the public sector and from your perspective, why it was so critical that you did what you did.
Well, I always have been, I'm not so pessimist about the future of cities, because when we project a tragedy, we'll have the tragedy. So we have to invest our energy to avoid trends that they are not desirable. And I'm after working almost 40 years in cities, I started with 5 years, and after working, I realized that every city could improve its quality of life in less than 3 years. But it has to be done very fast. Why? One, to avoid our own bureaucracy. The second, to avoid political problems. Sometimes when the political decision is done, after all the discussion is done, you have to start immediately. But the third, which is more important, sometimes we have a very good idea and we don't start because we try to figure out, oh, it's a very good idea, probably it shouldn't be feasible. So it's the insecurity. And we have to avoid insecurity and do it immediately. So that's why every problem in a city has its own equation of co-responsibility. I'll give you some examples. We didn't have the money to build a system of public transport. We didn't have the money to buy a fleet. The cost was $250 million. So what was the equation of co-responsibility? The city designed the system, and we proposed for the private initiative. We're going to invest in the itinerary. Boarding stations, terminals, and you're going to invest in the fleet, and we're going to pay you by kilometer. And it's done, it's one, now we started with 25,000 passengers per day, we're transporting 2 million passengers per day. The system is sustainable, it pays by itself, it's not subsidized, and it's one of the best systems in the world.
But this was only possible because someone at the very beginning had this vision, had this idea.
Yes. And I'm very happy to say that it took 25 years until one mayor, which is the mayor of Bogota, he invested in surface system. And he did a very good job. And now we have 83 cities all over the world. And I'm not trying to say which system is the best, if it's underground, if it's buses. My vision of mobility is every system is good. We have to have a smart subway. If you have a subway, we have to have a smart bus, smart taxi, a smart bike, everything. It has, and there is one condition for mobility which is very, very important. Never compete in the same space. That means you can link all the system, and if we want to use your car, okay, but it has to be linked to all the systems, and you will have more space, and the cities will be more visible.
Just to be clear, you said 83 cities around the globe. What are you referring to?
They are implementing bus rapid transport systems. I believe the future is on the surface, but we have to use what we have. London, Moscow, Paris, and New York, they have subways and very complete networks. But it's very hard now to build a complete network. Very expensive. We have to sacrifice whole generations. Here in New York, the Second Avenue line, they were discussing the Second Avenue line for 50 years. And if they'll start next year or this year, it will take more 20 years. 70 years, the cost of $4 billion, and this line would not transport more passengers than the bus that goes in front of my house.
So, Mayor... So, Mayor Livingston, sometimes democracy is not good for urban planning?
I don't know about that. Very often you find the situation that people are frightened about change, worried about change. I know... As we got close to introducing congestion charge in London, the number of people who are doubtful massively increased, about a third of the population. But it does require a combination of leadership. You've got to carry people with you. We had an amazing statistic come out last week, which was that 4 years ago in London, 38% of people used their car every day. That figure is now 18%. Some of that's congestion charge, some of that copying what has been done as a massive expense of the bus system. But I think people are waking up to the fact this is a desperate race against time to tackle climate change. In Britain, we have an independent, government-funded, an independent climate change analysis agency called Tyndall Centre. Last week, their best analysis was that we have 4 to 10 years to avoid the tipping point to irreversible climate change. Now, when I came into my office 6 years ago, people were talking about middle of the century. It is just much more urgent than we thought. And yet, I think people are now ready for that. They recognize they have to change their lives, as well as governments and city governments having to change infrastructure.
William McDonough, that's a pretty stark number there, 4 to 10 years. I mean, and that's just in Great Britain.
Well, we're working on six cities in China right now, and the kinds of instructions that we're getting from Tiananmen Square include admonitions like the current urbanization of China, if continued at the current pace, will mean we lose 25% of China's farmland by 2020, 25% of the farmland. And from an ecological perspective, that's a disaster, because not only do they take the best farmland as they expand the cities, but they put pressure on the hinterland where the ecologically sensitive areas are. So it's a nightmare. If they build out of brick, they've calculated that they in 174 major jurisdictions, they will lose all their soil and burn all their coal, making brick. So we have to come up with whole new sets of materials in order to do this. They expect to build housing for 400 million people in the next 12 years. This would be like rehousing the entire United States in 7 years. The scale is enormous. And the challenges, as we've heard at this conference, are to address climate change with a high sense of urgency. And how do you take this exploding supernova and shift it very quickly? And the only way we've seen is by design, where design is the first signal of human intention. The intention is to not have the tragedies that are currently being made by humans. They're in the making, literally, and to come up with alternative designs. And so it's the time for humans to imagine the perfectly exquisite in order to achieve the practically impossible.
And is that, from where you sit, Mr. Nilekani, is that realistic?
No, I think, it's doable, but I think we have to understand some ground realities. First of all, I think urbanization in a developing country dramatically increases the value of land. Because today an apartment in New York, in Mumbai, costs more than an apartment in New York. So what's happening is that land becomes very, 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 very precious. And it becomes a source of income for all kinds of people in the system. And if you can't enforce the use of land in a proper way, you will have all these issues. I'll give an example in Bangalore. Bangalore is 3,000 feet above sea level. And actually it was designed as a very sustainable city. It has tremendous green cover. It had a system of lakes and ponds to actually harvest the rain and use it for the city. And over time, these lakes and ponds became very valuable land. And therefore, the land was taken over and converted into houses or commercial complexes or malls or whatever. And the entire system of using the local rain for water was destroyed. And now we pump water from 300 kilometers away from a river and spend a lot of energy and time to get that. But the reason is because the land value goes up in such a manner that it actually attracts the subversion of the land to other purposes. So unless we have a way to figure out how do we have good planning and enforce it so that land is not appropriated, we will not be able to implement a lot of these good ideas.
Well, it's one thing to be able to do it in China where the government can dictate, can mandate. It's another thing to do it in a democratic society where, as we've heard, it takes years and years to reach consensus. So how do you work around that?
Well, I think and a lot of that, as I said, is because of the migration. You have new people coming in and they have no place to stay, so they'll stay wherever they get a place to stay. So you really can't. I think it's doable by creating a far more participatory form of democracy. It's by empowering the municipalities and the cities much better. It's about involving citizens in making those choices. It's about information sharing. A lot of this is because of the opacity of governance, so that you don't really know what's happening behind the scene. So I think there are a set of sort of techniques that you can work out to really improve that. But we have to recognize that the pace of change is very fast, the pace of migration is very high, land values will keep going up, and unless we have solutions that recognize these real-world issues, you'll only have theoretical solutions.
Mayor Lerner, are the solutions agreed on? Can we now assume we know what the solutions are and we just have to implement them?
We have to start, and start immediately. 50% of innovation is starting. And when you want a creative solution, try to cut a zero from your budget. Sometimes cut two zeros, you'll have more creativity. The problem is, let's put the question of sustainability. We came so perplexed. It's a kind of paralysis, as our former Vice President Al Gore said. We want to help and we don't know. We try to work with issues that we don't know. But there's a lot of issues that we already know that could be done. And by yourself, that means, if we're speaking about commitments, I have five commitments. One, use less your car. Of course, you have to have a good alternative on public transport. Second, separate your garbage. We'll come later on this issue. Third, live closer to your work or bring work closer to home. Fourth, save more and waste less. And fifth, multiple uses in every space. We cannot spend, we cannot waste, let's say, building an arena, as I said, in New Jersey. I was a former basketball player. I didn't have I'm a Nash, the name of the good player, which is very small. But I went to see, and I saw they are using this arena for 10 times a year when they are they were in the playoffs. So, an arena could be a very good market in the mornings. In the afternoons, a university. In the evenings, for events. So everyone has to understand that they can, in their daily life, they can make the difference. But we have to teach the children. And it's amazing the results that we can have when we start teaching children. For instance, when we wanted to separate our garbage, we teach our children, all of our children, during 6 months in the schools. The children, they teach their parents. And after, it was easy to campaign, to make a campaign, because we have, since 1989, we have the highest rate of separation of garbage in the world, 70%. Because the children, they teach their parents. About sustainability, if we could have some spaces, I made a project for a museum of sustainability. It's not a museum, it's a space for sustainable games. It's a way where every child could understand how, what is the what the carbon emissions from their house to the school in one trip, 1 year, 20 years. If it's a number, it will show and the ozone layoff. So every time when you want to make it happen, you have to build a scenario that everyone or the large majority, they'll understand it is desirable.
But Mayor Livingston, it is important to teach the children so that as they grow up, they will not only teach their parents, they'll live this when they're adults. But in the meantime, what do we do? How do you force solutions in a political environment that's not always friendly to what you want to accomplish?
Well, I think actually the thing to get across, we're not waiting for any new technology. Everything that we need to do to achieve the reduction in emissions, we have the technology. It's about making sure we drive it forward. And I think one way that, as you just said, children are incredible. I mean, we have a program of educating our children now in London about a whole range of environmental issues, one of which, I mean, the most difficult for people of an older generation to come to terms with is that, I mean, the water you use in your house to flush your toilet has been cleansed to drinking standard. It's really ridiculous. You wouldn't do that now. You'd have a separate grey water system. And we've got kids all over London saying, as their parents say, why haven't you flushed it? And the mayor says, you mustn't flush the loo, mummy. You know? And this is a huge impact. Where it gets more difficult is where you actually have to impact with, I mean, a degree of restraint, usually financial. The congestion charge worked because we massively expanded the bus fleet and we got new buses, so it's attractive, but we charged $8 a day to drive into the city. And people accepted that. What we've now started is to say that, and it's in line with what California's doing, that you really shouldn't drive an unnecessarily polluting car. Our electric cars have zero carbon emissions. A Prius does about a fifth of what a sports utility vehicle does. And I've now started consulting with Londoners on saying, we will charge $50 a day if you drive an SUV or similarly polluting vehicle in London. Now, the initial poll results are 3-1 in favour. I think a lot of parents and grandparents are getting very scared that the world they're leaving their children is going to be intolerable. And there's one big change that individuals can't make, which the conference hasn't really touched on yet. 60% or more of all the energy we create, whether it's nuclear or coal or gas or oil, is wasted by the process of cooling and discharging the heated water into the local river or sea. And therefore, what you call district heating and what we in Europe call combined heat and power or decentralized energy, go to Stockholm, their whole city runs on that. We can cut our use of resources for creating electricity by 2/3 by moving to a decentralized system so that in the city you are generating the electricity and you're using the heated water from the cooling process to actually heat district housing. That's a huge change. Government needs to weigh in. And big business comes to me prepared to take much more radical decisions than any government minister. I mean, our energy supplier in London, EDF, has come and said, let's start with £25 million to start this process in a recycling fund.
How common is that around the globe?
I suspect all over. Governments are so nervous. They've been, spin doctors and pollsters and focus groups have undermined their will which in many cases wasn't very strong to begin with. They want to see the polls say it's going to be popular before they do it. And therefore, big business is ahead of that. A lot of people who are mayors, if you're a mayor or state governor, the problem's on your doorstep, on your desk every day. You have to move quicker. I think the weakest link now in actually creating the global climate change consensus is national governments.
William McDonough. Okay. Coming from the private sector, as an architect, as a designer, please react to what he said, but then I want to hear from you what's the ideal design of a city of the future?
Well, I think our clients range from Google. We're doing their corporate campus, so it's a company that has very advanced thoughts on how they're going to deal with their people and how they're going to get to work, and they're very concerned about all those kinds of things, same things that Nandan was talking about. We also see governors and mayors coming and saying, what is the ideal state, and then how can we work toward it? And so, for example, with Mayor Newsom, we're doing a protocol for a large development the city is proffering, which is Treasure Island, and we've been asked to put out a sustainability matrix that represents 100% exquisite sustainability and then drive the developers to respond to that matrix as well as they can and push them towards whatever practical reality is even possible. And it's parallel to what Jaime was talking about in terms of taking a zero off. It forces innovation. And so it doesn't accept that you're just going to do what you did yesterday. It says we're forcing innovation. We're not saying that you're going to do something that's unprofitable. We're just saying we want you to think. You know, we don't want you to just do what you did yesterday. You're going to have to do something new or we're never going to get there. And so we're seeing governors and mayors leading these kinds of charges by putting out a vision of what they want and being able to say, I want. It was the same thing we heard from Lee Scott in the other room, where Walmart just has to say, I want, and the supply chain has to respond.
What's the incentive for them to go along with this?
They get to do the project. They get to make something immensely profitable. That's the simple response.
I want you to respond.
No, I think certainly you need multiple forces of change, and it won't just be political leaders because they have to think about reelectability, but other parties. For example, in India, an interesting thing has been the role the courts have played in driving sustainability. For example, a lot of environmentalists went to the Supreme Court and talked about pollution in Delhi, and the court came and said mandated that all the public bus system should move to natural gas. And they actually got it done, and there was a significant improvement and lowering of pollution in Delhi. So I think there are different stakeholders. There are businesses who will drive it. There'll be the courts who will drive it. There'll be environmentalists who will drive it. There'll be, you know, visionary politicians who will drive it. So I think we really have to look at getting all these people to play their role in driving this whole change forward.
And we have time. We have time for this to happen.
I mean, you don't have a choice, you know. If there are going to be 400 million people in China going to move into cities, and there are going to be 300 million people in India going to move to cities in the next 15 years. If you don't get this, get your act together, you know, you have a serious problem. So I think we have no choice but to embrace all these things.
Bill McDonough.
Just to build on that, working with the Chinese government, one of their expressed fears, and it's not highly public, is in the last five-year plan, they've literally pulled back on urbanization dramatically after 10 years of encouraging it, because they wanted to build industry and grow their economy in double-digit rates. They're now pulling back dramatically, and their biggest fear is that people will migrate to the cities and not find jobs. And if they don't find jobs, they'll create favelas. And if they create slums, there will be foment of revolution, because you take lots of people, you put them in desperate situations, and you compact them, and you've got an incendiary crucible. And they're very anxious about this. So for the future of cities, this is a key question. Are the cities going to be in a position to welcome these people? Because if they don't welcome them and they don't feel welcome, then they'll destroy the city.
Yes, I think the position of China is quite interesting, because no one in the West saw the impact of the Industrial Revolution on the environment. It spanned lifetimes. They've seen it in 25 years. And so politicians who are starting their careers there are now having to tackle the problem. And they are taking, I'm really envious. They've taken some decisions on photovoltaic cells that's going to bring the global price down 2/3. We're talking with architects in London about importing them. Jeremy Leggett, who's also here, has created a roof tile which looks just like a standard roof tile, doesn't change the appearance of the house, but is a photovoltaic cell. And it is
How much more expensive is it?
Initially, it's a little bit more expensive. But if you actually, if a government commits to say, we will make it mandatory, every south-facing route should have these, the price will come down. It's no different. I mean, the Tony Blair's government is about to devolve to my office the allocation of the $3 billion public housing subsidy. It's for construction, not a rent subsidy. And I intend, when that comes over later this year, to bring the architects and the housing association people in and say, look, we're not going to allocate that money to any new home for construction that isn't absolutely state-of-the-art. It may not be possible to be absolutely carbon neutral, but it's going to be as close as possible. Therefore, massive insulation, use of photovoltaics, and I'm not interested in subsidising any housing that adds to the problem. If you want, I mean, a commitment from me at this conference, it's that that $3 billion won't subsidise another polluting public sector home in London.
How many other cities around the planet are doing something like this?
I'm sorry. No. I'm worried about what is the result of a bad concept for a city. Are we having our cities living here, working here, having leisure here? This is going to be a waste of energy and a waste of our own energy. We have to understand that our society is, we have to have a structure of living and working together. Every time when we separate the economic activities from the human settlements, we have the disaster. Not only in cities, in states, in countries. So if we're working only with economics and forgetting people, it's a disaster. My example of a good concept for a city is the turtle. Because the turtle carries its house, works, and it's an example of living and working together. You could imagine how unhappy could be the turtle if we cut the cask of the turtle in different ways. She's going to be very unhappy. Because living here, working here, having leisure here. So the concept of the city has to be changed. We cannot, it's not possible anymore for having cities only on private cars. I'm not against private cars, owning a car, but in the daily, the routine itinerary, it has to be changed. We cannot have more cities that where people want to live in cities and they're living outside the city. This is, or in ghettos. Or for rich people, ghettos for poor people. I have a hard time once in a debate about biodiversity. There was a lady that was very tough about biodiversity. So I asked her, what about, where are you living? Well, I'm living in this neighborhood. Do you have commerce in your nearby? No, I don't have. But you have any different incomes in your neighborhoods? No, we don't have. So if you are so far, so you stand so straight for biodiversity, in your own biodiversity you don't accept. So we have to have social diversity. That is the link for less violent cities, more safe cities, where in more trade with formal and informal sector.
But how do you keep that from being a utopia? Because, as you've just described, that's the way most people organize themselves. Now,
always
you work in one place, you live in another place, you recreate in another place.
When I was a mayor, we gave incentives for the functions that were lacking. That means, if downtown area we didn't have housing, we try to give incentives for housing programs, for education facilities. So the more people will bring, more life we'll have. That's many cities are doing that, fortunately. The problem is we cannot have places with very good infrastructure empty for 16 hours a day. So we have to understand that every city, there are areas that can play different roles during the 24 hour. But
let me ask Mr. McDonough, but we're really talking about two things here. We're talking about designing cities for the future and being really smart about that, but we're also talking about urgent need to make changes in the cities as they are right now. I mean, do you separate it like that in your own work, in your own thinking?
We have to separate it in our work because of just working with reality. The kinds of things that we find is that we can bring messages from the future back to the present and start to say, what do these ideal states tell us about what we could do right now? And that's where the utopianism is actually a useful, practical thing. And then you do what Jaime's talking about, which is not a minimization of the bad, but an optimization of the good, which has a much richer mix, because being less bad is not being good, it's being bad, just less so. And if you left New York heading for Canada and you find yourself going 100 miles an hour and you're supposed to be going to Mexico, it's not going to help you to slow down to 20. You're going the wrong way. So we really need to know what does 100% good look like in order to even begin to function. And then when you bring it down to the existing cities, you realize that Einstein said no problem can be solved by the same consciousness that created it. So then you have to go into another consciousness and start to look at how to solve a problem with reality on the ground. And I'll give you an example. We see that the destruction of the cities in the United States, for example, has been caused by cars mainly, where people have been able to move to the suburbs and leave the cities. It's ironic that in the developing world, the cities are getting crowded. In the developed world, the cities are being left. And so we could see that the new transportation systems could be operated by elders, since we expect, and with good health care, that some of us will live to 130. What are we going to do? The 65-year-old retirement age was set by Otto von Bismarck at the turn of the century because it was the average age when 98% of the male population was dead. So you work till you drop is what it used to be. Now we're going to have very vital elders. And wouldn't it be marvelous if the elders were moving the children around using advanced technology, and all of a sudden you bring the generations back together and let that become the preferred mobility system. And then you connect that to the kind of thing that Jaime is talking about, and you could start right away by saying the parks give preference to elders moving children, just immediately. And all of a sudden they have the best transportation instead of no transportation, things like that.
Automakers taking a real beating here. I don't know if anybody's out here from the big.
The automakers are being given an amazing opportunity to participate in a productive way.
Nandan Nilekani, tell me, in India, population, what is it, 700? I don't know. Thank you.
1.1 billion.
Okay, 1.1. How many people who are in a position of influence understand what you understand about what needs to be?
No, I think the understanding is rapidly coming in. You know, for many years in India, urbanization was seen as something that was sort of a necessary evil. It was going to happen anyway. But we didn't really have a formal program for dealing with these challenges. But the good thing is, in the last 2 years, there's a much bigger focus on urbanization. There's actually a huge movement now called the National Urban Renewal Mission, which is taking 63 cities across the country and seeing how they can become better cities. And I think that's really the key to it, getting people to realize that urbanization is inexorable, it's inevitable. If it's done well, it's a good thing for society. If it's not done well, it's a bad thing for society. And therefore, how proactive can we be to solve that? And I think the other thing which is becoming becoming clearer is that it's a very complex issue. You know, I mean, there's the issue of the politics of urbanization, which is a very big issue in India and China. There's the financing of urbanization. How do we pay for all this stuff? Where's the money for that? The third is, how do you make sure that it's environmentally sustainable? I mean, we talked about some of that. How do we make sure that we provide public services of all kinds for rich and poor? And finally, how do we make sure cities are socially and culturally and creative and you know, encourage diversity and creativity? So I think we have to really look at it at different levels, and the real thinking people have to figure out a multidimensional approach to this whole thing.
Given that, what do you worry about in terms of realizing the vision you have?
I think it's the pace of change, because even as we discuss this, you know, 10,000 people are probably moving into some city somewhere, and therefore, unless we get our hands around this very rapidly, I think we will be overcome by the pace of this. And you know, if you are running a city and it's just inundated by migrants, you just give up one day and say, I can't deal with this anymore, and that's the risk that we have to worry about.
I think, can I say, the thing that worries me the most is the thing where everyone virtually has to sign up. A lot of what we're doing, some cities are taking lead, some governments. But in Britain, we're very proud of the fact we reduce our carbon emissions by 14-15% below their 1990 levels. But that entire saving has been taken up by aviation. And our plans to reduce our carbon emissions by 60% by 2050, on present growth rates, that entire saving will be taken up by aviation. And the really difficult
one... What do you mean by that?
Well, the increase in air travel is actually creating more carbon emissions than we're saving from everything else we're doing. Now, what that faces politicians with is saying people have to recognise the real cost of their travel. And for the huge growth that's been in very cheap flights, Ryanair and so on, and what we have to really say is every plane must pay the cost in carbon terms of actually getting off the ground. And the weakness, we're all locked into a treaty created after the Second World War, which basically exempts aviation from virtually every form of taxation. And that is a luxury we can no longer afford. I mean, what's changed patterns of travel in London? Londoners are faced with the real environmental cost of their travel. We can still avoid that just by the air travel we take. And until governments are prepared to get together and say, we amend the international treaty in 1948 so that we have the tax mechanism in place that actually replenishes, takes out the carbon emission growth that we've got in air travel, we could end up doing all that we want in cities and still find global warming becoming irreversible because people want to go and have a cheap foreign holiday.
So it wouldn't lead to less air travel?
It will lead to less air travel, whereas with cars and cities, the technologies are there that we can change very rapidly. The life of a plane is 30 years, and the technologies are nowhere near close enough for a sort of a zero-carbon plane. I'm not saying it's ever going to happen. I mean, you're not going to get a plane take off fueled by photovoltaic wings. You know, it needs all sitting on a bomb to get off the ground. That's the reality of it. And therefore, it's the most difficult nut to crack and could be the single most unpopular to say to people, we're going to slap another $15 to $20 on every ticket you take.
Mayor Lerner, you're nodding.
Well, I used to say that the car is like our mother-in-law. Because we have to have good relationship with her. But we cannot live she'll command our lives. That means in every city when I'm working, there's always that kind of saying, oh, how about the car? We cannot leave space for public transport because the car, don't pay attention to the car. Yes, pay attention to your mother-in-laws, of course. But don't be so pressed by the car. Because when we implemented the good public transport system, we realized that almost 30% of our people having cars in our countries, a car is a social conquest, and they moved for public transport, 30%. Can you imagine how could be our cities with less people, 30% of less people running in cars? So anyway, I know the cars, they are being improved in their emissions, but anyway, it will take time, as Mayor Livingston said, it will take time, and we have to work on a more in a concept of a more integrated city, and where you can renew, you can use all the system you can have. If you want to use your car, it's okay. You're going to park in a parking lot, and at the same time you will have a valet service, and you will take a van that will take you closer to your office. But you're going to use a public system, and you're going to pay a mobility card. That means if you're using a car, you'll pay more than the people that they are using more public transport. So you can use everything which is easier for you. But you have to understand you could never compete in the same space. There's another issue which is sometimes we don't understand how important is the mixed use for our cities. It's a mistake that was done during years and years, decades, separating living from working. And most of Europe, it's keeping better. But here in the U.S., or in some cities, you have the most crowded city I met. It was Montpellier in France during summer. 300 people. It was, I took, I have a jam, we have a jammed traffic for more than 3 or 4 hours, more than in Paris, in London, everywhere. By the way, I took a taxi in London, and I asked him, how is your mayor?
He's in a representative sample.
And he told me, I hate him. But I asked him, but is he a good mayor? He's a wonderful mayor. But I hate him because I have to pay the taxes for, that's the answer. Sometimes you have to face reactions. It's working in a city. It's like giving a concert. You never have a consensus. Democracy is a process of conflicts. So if I'm playing here a violin, I'm looking to the audience and 20% they are not liking my music. I won't stop the concert and I would ask, why you're not liking my music? I would finish the concert and after I talk to them. I realized that you didn't like my music. Why? And I don't have the feedback from them.
That may be the most benign description I've ever heard of a democracy. That it's like a concert. I want to come to you, William McDonough, on this point of what are you, one of these points that we've discussed, and what do you worry about? I mean, you all are very clear, it seems to me, in terms of what you think should be done, but.
One of the biggest concerns that we haven't brought up, as Jaime brought it up at the beginning, is the question of trash. If you look at a city, we have to look in the future at cities as part of metabolisms. They are, like symphonies and poems, objects of human artifice, and they're within the natural world. And if 80% of our cities are going to be in large bodies of water, which they are, and we need to see them as metabolisms. And if you look at Einstein's equation, E equals MC squared, you've got E and M. And we have a lot of E coming from the sun, so we will solve the energy problem. We have a very small amount of M coming in as income, right? It takes a huge amount of E to make a small amount of M, and vice versa. That's why Hiroshima disappeared, small M, big E. But if we look at the mass of the planet, we have a certain amount of chromium in South Africa, a certain amount of nickel in Africa, a certain amount of graphite in China, and so on. And if we take that mass and then spread it around the world and toxify the Earth, while we lose the quality of the mass, we will never recover from this. We don't have energy income. We have 5,000 times more energy income striking the Earth's surface than humans will ever need, even at 10 billion of us. So we will solve the energy problem, That should be dealt with with immense urgency, as we've all heard here. But the other problem is the mass problem. We are toxifying at a very quick rate and losing the values of these nutrients. So cities become a key part of that nutrient flow. So the way we see it in the future is that cities are the home of what we call technical nutrition. They're the home of jobs, they're the home of production, they're the homes of the making of things. The countryside is the home of biological nutrition. It is the solar absorption being transferred into carbohydrates, sugars, and so on. And so we need to develop a relationship between the city and the countryside, where the countryside provides the biological nutrition to the city. The city takes that biological nutrition and returns it to the countryside to refurbish it. So the city sewage treatment plants are really fertilizer factories that make methane gas and so on and so forth.
How far away are we now from realizing something like that?
They're what we call the essay of clues out there now. We can see, just like Jaime was saying, elements of this in different places. So it's a matter of developing best practice and then aggregating. We're seeing sewage treatment plants that are fertilizer factories that make methane or methane gas, CH4. It looks like CH4 can do 24% of a city's cooking. We're seeing plants that can do this now. We're seeing all the elements of what I just described exist. They're state of the shelf. What no one's ever done is aggregate them all into one protocol. And that's what's coming and has to come quickly.
All right, we've only got about 5 minutes left. I want to ask each of you to speak to the audience here at the Clinton Global Initiative in terms of what can each person take away from this? What can they either know or what can they do that could make a difference in the future of the cities of this planet?
Well, I think if we can all recognize that urbanization is inevitable, inexorable, but if you really tackle it in a multidimensional way, look at the financial, political, environmental, public service, and cultural aspects of it, and really put it into effect in each of the cities where we live, I think we can make a huge difference.
You make it sound easy, but...
Well, I mean, as I said, you better do this, because, I mean, if you're going to have 700 million people moving into cities, unless we do it, you know, we have a big problem.
Mayor Livingston?
Well, I think that the fact that the Clinton Foundation came along to the cities that were doing climate change work and said, want to get involved in this, spread best practice, is going to be a huge boost in all of this. And we're looking for mass purchasing of the latest technologies that will bring the price down. And we can do a lot, individual cities and all of that. But the real reality we face is that the next American president and the next president of France and the next prime minister of Britain and this German chancellor have to drive through the changes in their first terms, or we may slip into that irreversible tipping point. And this means an incredibly mature debate has got to happen in the next few months and couple of years at most in the major Western democracies. Because you are not going to be able to say to the peoples of India and China, while we are squandering resources and producing a waste on a scale which is absolutely scandalous and catastrophic and toxic, that they should hold back if we aren't driving forward the process of change. And we have all the capacity we have. What we require now is the political will. I think, imagine where we might be if the election in 2000 in America had gone the other way and you'd had an administration that accepted the climate change problem, rather than one that's taken about 6 years, and it seems to me they seem to be on the verge of saying there might be a bit of a problem out there. If America gets it wrong, it's going to be very difficult to see a way forward for the rest of humankind.
Yes.
Mayor Lerner.
I think if all the countries will be more generous about their own cities, they will be more generous with their own people. We have to globalize solidarity. So, and that means some governments, they are not paying attention to the cities. Most of them, they understand the cities are externalities from the economic problem.
You want to name names?
Well, this country, and many countries, my country. So they don't pay attention for the cities. and how urgent it has to be done. And sometimes they're looking for the examples of what is the city of the future. Sometimes we think the future will have, like the optimists think, landscape of Flash Gordon landscape, or the more pessimists of Blade Runner landscape. But we have to understand that the cities in the future will not be so different than the cities of today, because the city of today, physically, they are not different from cities from 300 years ago. What is going to be the big change? The diminution of the scale of the generators of jobs. That means factories for clothing, food. So fortunately for the future of the cities, we could have jobs closer to our homes, including services. So we have to take advantage for this, for this, all this technology which is available for us. But we have to be, the cities are our last refuge of solidarity. If we don't understand, we have to give quick answers for housing, education, healthcare, care of children. Everything could be fast. You can do it in fast ways. Mobility, sustainability, start. Because most of the people, they want to have all the answers. We cannot have all the answers. We have to start and understanding that people will correct you if you're not in the right track.
William McDonough, you get the last word here.
Well, let me just leave with the word love. I think the key to me is that we have to find a way to love all the children in our cities as quickly as possible, because if the children sense the hope, then they can start to manifest that hope. And if our time frame is, say, 10 years, and we can get the next round of leadership ready to act quickly, that might be a very hopeful thing if the present round of leadership isn't in a position to act as quickly as necessary. And I know in Curitiba they built all their little libraries instead of a central library, following Jaime's sense of how to do things, put them all on the edge of the city and all through the city so they're within reach of every child. And he had a political problem that people from the favelas were sending their children into the city's libraries, and the people in the city complained, why are these children who don't have parents who pay taxes coming and using our libraries? And Jaime's response is, we did that on purpose because we have to love all those children in the favelas too, because if we don't love those children will grow up to hate the city. And if they grow up to hate the city, they will destroy the city. And I think we see the same thing with cities in relation to the larger global environment. If we're going to be mostly aggregated in cities as a species, and we find ourselves not loving our own children and giving them hope, and then we don't love the environment, and we don't love all the other species of all the children of other species, then the children of other species will destroy humankind. So I think the city is going to have to be the home of love. And if it's the home of love, and then it's the home of hope.
Thank you very much. Thank you.